doing everything you can to infuse your world with the faith. So, send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. God bless you, be a blessing, and pray for the future of our country. Let's elect some good people.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily those of IRN, its advertisers, or affiliates.
Obviously, if the serotonin level was already high,
thank you very much.
We're having horrible problems because it's making everything worse. In fact, there was a study done out of Australia a few years ago. Dr. Murray Esler headed the study, and it was done on patients that are suffering from anxiety, post-traumatic stress, things like that. And he was shocked to find that their serotonin levels were 8 times higher than normal. He said, oh my gosh, why are we giving them these drugs that increase serotonin levels? And of course I sat back and said, well, what do you think I've been trying to tell you all these years? So that's the first problem. We know that increased serotonin levels produce things like mania, which is increased, by the way, we now call that bipolar. That has had a 4,000% increase over just the last 10-year period.
Now you're speaking now a 4,000% increase in mania or what?
Yeah, right, or bipolar disorder.
All right, fine.
So we're chemically inducing this in so many people. But we also know that high serotonin leads to suicide. It can lead to violent crime. Arson, substance abuse. First thing I saw with these drugs were the cravings for alcohol that were just absolutely incredible. People becoming alcoholic almost overnight. But now we've reached the point point where the most popular of these drugs on the market today, Effexor, now has homicidal ideation listed as a side effect.
In fact, didn't you say that this fellow who was over there at the Virginia Tech, you know, killed all the people, was actually somehow or other had been on these drugs in the past?
Well, the first report we got on that one was the police were saying that they found antidepressants, and then his roommates were saying, yes, that he took his medication that morning and went, you know, just a normal day, got up, took his medication, and went on. We know he was being treated for depression.
Oh, do we know what drug he was taking?
Hit it all now.
Oh, did we have any idea what drug he was taking?
They didn't even release the toxicology.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Ann Blake Tracy. Well, of course, one of the big problems is people get homicidal, don't they, when they're on these drugs?
Well, yes. Homicidal ideation means constant ruminating thoughts of killing and how to kill. That's the side effect.
And, of course, you know, we're seeing, people who actually, some of our veterans coming home from overseas, you know, are depressed or put on these psychotropic drugs, and they'll just black out and kill the person who's most important to them. They don't even remember doing it.
Exactly. And that is cosmic. It's a condition known as a REM sleep behavior disorder. Ambien has gotten a little bit of press on that disorder over the last little while. It's where you actually act out what it is that you're dreaming. We know, though, that 86% of the cases being diagnosed are patients taking an antidepressant. 86% of that disorder. We also know that 80% of those going into that disorder hurt themselves or someone else.
Well, what percent of the patients who do have, who take the Prozac or serum serotonin reabsorption inhibitors, what percent of those will get this abnormal reaction? Because it must help some of the patients, doesn't it?
There are a lot of patients that claim that they have been helped, yes.
Okay, go ahead. Just speak right up. Speak right up here, please. Go ahead.
Generally, those are patients that don't know what the side effects are. Not everyone is going to suffer the worst side effects, just like not everyone suffers the worst side effects from an adverse reaction to penicillin. But we do know that 7 to 10% of the population don't even have the liver enzyme system they need to metabolize these drugs. So, of course, they're going to hit toxic levels quickly. 7 to 10% of those taking these drugs is a pretty high number anymore.
And then, of course, they're selling an awful lot of Prozac and these other drugs. And are they warning people about the possible suicidal or homicidal ideologies that may come up when you're on these drugs? See, that's the problem, is that the patients don't realize that. And what about with children? My understanding is that only recently have they put a black box warning on. And hold that, just we'll be back
exactly
in just a moment here.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Tracy has been campaigning against Prozac for a good period of time. She's even written a book, Prozac, Panacea or Plague, and she's published that really at her own expense. She's looked at by most doctors, oh my goodness, you know, just always complaining. But she's pointing out that, what is it, 7 to 10% of people don't have the enzymes in the liver to actually detoxify these drugs. Is that right?
That's right.
All right, and of course, if you don't detoxify it, then it just keeps on working, and you keep getting higher and higher serotonin levels
right
in your brain. And when you do, you can get all sorts of abnormal reactions, including homicidal ideas and suicidal ideas. And, of course, there have been a fair number of people who've been on these drugs who actually committed murders and have killed themselves. So you pick the story up there, Dr. Tracy.
Well, one very important thing to point out is that the head of the National Institute of Mental Health came out in August and finally said what I said clear back in 1994, and that is that these drugs are almost identical in action to PCP, angel dust. And what he said was that they had just run a study using ketamine. Ketamine is known in the street as Special K. It is a sister drug to PCP, and it is also a dissociative anesthetic. What a dissociative anesthetic is, in case your listeners aren't real familiar with it, is a drug that will anesthetize you, and yet you can still move and act and talk, and therefore you can work with the doctor. They thought that that would be good in certain cases. So he said that these drugs work the same way. They tested the ketamine and found that ketamine got rid of depression immediately. Well, of course, anyone going under anesthesia is going to not feel anything, including depression. But what's scary is he just went on to say that they work the same way. Antidepressants take a little bit longer to produce the same effect. So he was trying to say that what we need is a drug like ketamine that doesn't produce hallucinations, that would get rid of depression immediately. And what everyone should have said was, my gosh, these are anesthetics. Why are you anesthetizing this huge number of the population and telling them that this is a cure? Because when you look at brainwave patterns of somebody on one of these medications, that is exactly what you see, is an anesthetized brain.
With very, very high serotonin levels. Well, I certainly, you know, let's talk a little bit about the children. What happens when you give these drugs to children, and what has been done recently?
Well, we know that children and the elderly are the two most likely groups to suffer adverse reactions from any medication. And recently the FDA did put black box warnings on antidepressants for anyone under the age of 18. And then just last year they increased that age to anyone under the age of 25.
All right. Now, of course, a black box warning means there's a big black box printed on the label that tells about the side effects. And because it's a big black box, why, you're supposed to read what's inside there, and that means that they want to caution you against that. And that's one of the things that the FDA does when they're concerned that there are all sorts of abnormal reactions. So they're saying that nobody younger than 25 should be taking this now?
Yeah.
No, but
it's
the closest thing
to banning a drug.
And, of course, but this was given to a lot of children. Doctors were just giving it because they were told that this was good for children.
Oh, yeah, I know. And yet they found that there was double the chance of suicide
in children who were taking the Prozac types of drugs then.
Right, which is why they put the black box warning on saying, you know, you better not be using them, or you better be extremely cautious. And yet, I've got families that have lost children within a week to these drugs.
I mean, it'll take over that quickly, and they'll get really depressed and suicidal within a week?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how many children? Do we have any idea how many children, have committed suicide on this? Or is it just that you have a practice, you know, because you've written a book about the dangers of Prozac, that people gravitate to you?
Well, and they have. We do have on our website at drugawareness.org, if you click up toward the upper left-hand corner, there's a big blue button that says Database of SSRI Cases of Violence and Suicide. And we've tried to document anything that comes out in the press, but most reporters really don't know enough to ask in these cases. I've spent years, of course, calling reporters, asking what we know, calling families, asking if they were on something. I called Phil Hartman's family the day after their death and said, don't you stop until you find one of these drugs, because it will be there. And then I worked with them until we got all of the information, and sure enough, she was on Zoloft, and that company has settled those wrongful death suits.
Now, who is Phil Hartman? I don't know the case.
Comedian Phil Hartman, news radio guy. Was on Saturday Night Live. He was one of the most popular, and he was really becoming extremely popular as a comedian. Very talented.
Okay, fine. So
and
basically,
his wife shot him, and then herself.
I see. And of course, they did find that she was actually on what was Zoloft.
Zoloft.
All right. And of course, this is the tragedy that if you're not looking for it, you don't know that these drugs make people homicidal or suicidal. Why then?
Right.
Then you're not going to look for it. You're not going to understand that. And it's just, well, it's just another case of domestic violence. So,
right. Well, another thing, too, is they're not being warned about mixing these drugs with other drugs. I mean, how many people are warned that you can't take cold or cough medications with these? If so, you get a PCP reaction.
No, by PCP, I mean you just become violently... violent as far as your reaction is concerned.
Right, you can be that. Like I had a 14-year-old girl that was weaning off of her Paxil, and she developed the cough that so often comes when you do that, because the main function of serotonin is constriction of smooth muscle tissue. So you get constriction of the bronchial tubes, constriction of the arteries, the veins. All the organs are smooth muscle tissue. When the serotonin level gets too high, you die of multiple organ failure, like Daniel Smith, Anna Nicole's son. He was taking 3 antidepressants plus methadone, all of which affect serotonin levels. His serotonin level just shot through the roof, and he died of multiple organ failure. That's what happened. So, anyway, this little girl was having her lungs start to congest because of that. And her mom, not knowing, gave her cough and cold meds. Well, on the second day, she literally ripped her schoolroom from one end to the other. And the mother called me in a panic. And I called back right after the mother had talked to me and asked if anyone had given her any orange juice to bring her blood sugar up, because I figured she was having an insulin shock-like reaction, which often goes hand-in-hand with these. And the head of the school, the administrator, said, yes, we've got 3 children that have diabetes, and all 3 of those... She just acted like any of those kids when they go into insulin shock. So, but anyway, you get that kind of a reaction when you mix these drugs. And that warning just does not get out to people. And one thing that is getting mixed often is a drug called Ultram, which is a painkiller. Ultram is an antidepressant. It is an SSRI, and doctors are prescribing it right along with this. Or they'll give trazodone along with it, saying that's for sleep. Trazodone's an SSRI as well. So they're mixing these drugs together, and it can be really dangerous for the patient. But you can't ever just stop one either.
What happens if you stop it suddenly? Is there
the FDA finally, along with the black box warning, said any abrupt change in dose of an antidepressant can cause suicide, hostility, or psychosis, generally a manic psychosis. So bipolar.
And
by
so
bipolar,
basically,
you
have to wean yourself off of these then.
Very slowly. Because I've got a tape or CD on how to come off the right way.
Well, of course, the thing is that you really become dependent upon these things, and the whole physiology of your brain changes
as
you're getting these very, very high levels of serotonin that God never intended us to have. We're going to be back here in just a moment. And if you have any questions at all, our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, Dr. Tracy, certainly, is there any concern within the general medical community? Certainly, I haven't had the opportunity to be dealing with this. This was way out of my field when I was practicing, and I haven't heard any discussions within the medical community when I go to my Friday meetings about the dangers of Prozac. Are the doctors becoming concerned about it?
No, they're all taking too much of it themselves. I just had a television crew come out from Moscow, Russia, to do a documentary on my work. And they wanted to film me doing a lecture. So I said, okay, we'll invite a few people over here to the house, and you can just film me giving a lecture to a group of people. That way it won't be, you know, just low-key and it'll be easy to do. So we sent out just a few flyers, had people coming from 7 hours away. But, of course, the house was full. We had two psychiatric nurses that attended. And one stood up after the lecture. And she said, Dr. Tracy, you need to know that we never get to hear what you've told us here tonight. But, she said, I'm on one of these drugs. I'm on Lexapro. And I've suffered everything that you've talked about tonight. I can't deny it, because I know I've gone through it. But she said, you don't know what's going on out here. She said, 75% of the doctors and nurses I work with are on these drugs. And of course, my first reaction was, oh my gosh, with amnesia listed as a frequent side effect of the drugs. That's how much it affects your memory. I said, how do you remember what your patients need? And she laughed and said, oh, we don't. And I caught my breath, and she said, we just kind of keep trying to remind each other what everybody needs, and then we laugh and joke about how we're getting older and forgetful. But she said, what drug reps are telling us is that we're in a very stressful profession, and that sooner or later we got to know that we're going to need these, so we may as well just start now so that we're kind of nipping it in the bud.
Do we have any idea how much of the Prozac is being sold, or how much of what percentage of the population is on Prozac?
No, they hide that really well. I know I did a story with Salt Lake City Magazine clear back in 92, and the reporter tried every way that she could to find out.
Well, okay, you know, there was a book called A Brave New World. I think it was Aldous Huxley.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that everybody was going to be on a drug. They were going to call it Soma. And
we're there.
That would make everybody feel better about themselves. I mean, they were all taking the drug. And that's really Prozac. It's so many people are on Prozac today. But what it's doing, we all have problems one time or another. But once you get on these things, it's very difficult to get off of them, and it totally alters the metabolism of your brain, and it gets your serotonin up level up. I know people who've taken it. They tell me they feel better, but what does it do over the long term as far as permanent changes in the brain? We're going to ask Dr. Tracy that and a lot of other questions, and we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Ann Blake Tracy. And Dr. Tracy, were you a general practitioner, psychologist, psychiatrist? What was your field?
I'm a PhD.
Oh, you're a PhD, okay.
Right. So I do more research and teaching.
All right. Well, is there any permanent effect? In other words, certainly we know that with a lot of medications, you're on them for a time, and for instance, Ritalin with children actually stunts their growth. Stunts their growth, shrinks the size of their
head.
So do
these drugs, because they're stimulants as well. If you've got an antidepressant, the opposite of a depressant, what is it? It's a stimulant. And these are strong stimulants. So they stunt the growth as well. I mean, one single 30 milligram dose of Prozac has been shown to double your cortisol level. So you got to know that growth is stunted, the bones are being affected. In fact, there's been studies come out recently talking about how the bones are extremely brittle for elderly taking these drugs. And there's been warnings come out. But I've never seen a group of drugs that just literally destroy every body system that there is. Diabetes is rampant with these drugs. You almost always end up losing your gallbladder.
Well, now, has there been any studies that have shown an increase of cholecystitis or gallbladder disease with that? Or is this just sort of an observation?
No, that's just what I've observed. As we've taken reports from patients, we'll ask, you know, what about your gallbladder? Have you been diagnosed with diabetes? What about symptoms of low blood sugar, the cravings for sugar or cravings for alcohol? And that's where we've seen it. And yet I finally checked the stats for the state of Utah, where they've had a high use of these drugs. And they have a high diabetic rate anyway. But so there's a pretty good increase in diabetes. But I checked for the year after the stats came in, after the first year after Prozac was on the market. And it went from about a 45-degree increase to, that line just shot straight in the air after that first year the Prozac was out. I couldn't believe the increase.
In other words, it's just a definite increase in, this is type 2 diabetes you're speaking of.
Right.
So the predisposed...
Of course, we don't know what it's doing to the offspring. I mean, it will be interesting years down the road to find out how many of the offspring of these people are ending up with type 1 diabetes.
Well, now, is there any problem, or are there any restrictions as far as giving the serum serotonin reabsorption inhibitors, SSRI drugs, to pregnant women?
Nope, not really. I see La Leche League pushing the drugs to pregnant and nursing women. I mean, now they deal mainly with nursing women, but there has been a real push to get pregnant women on these drugs of late. They're even talking about screening pregnant women for depression.
Well, now, what about the child? Is there any studies that show that there are no effects on the child?
There are huge numbers of lawsuits being filed for the horrible birth defects. Many children are being born with heart defects where they have to have open heart surgery right away, and they end up on medication for life, cutting their lives very short. There are children being born with their organs outside the body.
But of course, what they're going to say is, "Well, this happens anyway." Is there any statistics that show there's an increase in birth defects if you're taking this?
Yes. That's why they're winning. That's why the suits are being filed.
No, we certainly haven't heard about this at all. You know, and I try to keep my ears pretty well to the ground, so I know what's going on out there. So the cases are actually being settled on this, and we're not hearing about it in the major media?
I know. Well, they bring in like 200 million a day on antidepressants. Why would they want you to... When I did the Lisa Gibbons show a few years ago on mothers killing their children, we were told we could say antidepressant. We could not say the names of the drugs because of their advertisers. Go to drugawareness.org.
Okay, fine.
You can keep the, up.
Drugawareness.org. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Could this really be true? I fear that it is. Well, Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Dr. Ann Blake Tracy, and we're talking about the effects of the serotonin inhibitors, the serum SSRI, serum serotonin reabsorption inhibitors. And so if you inhibit the reabsorption of serotonin, then the serotonin stays and you get higher and higher levels. And this has the impact on people. Now, I know that some people, you know, and I've talked to them, have been on the SSRI drugs. They were depressed, and they don't feel depressed anymore. Have you talked to some people who've actually believe that they benefited from the SSRI drugs?
Oh, yeah. All the time. But once I start asking them questions, they find that they've had all kinds of reactions that they had no clue were related to the drug.
What sort of reactions would they have? Would you speaking of
specifically? Oh, for instance, I can think of someone. I went in to have a haircut, and the fellow that was cutting my hair, I started talking to him about some of these things, and he said, "Well, I was on one of these drugs for a while, and I didn't have any side effects. I got off, and I'm fine." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, what about your memory?" Because that's one of the most common things, is memory loss. And he said, "Well, wow, my memory got really bad. Is that related to the drug?" And and then I said, "What about cravings for sugar or NutraSweet?" And he said, "I was drinking Diet Pop like I couldn't believe how much I was drinking." And he said, "That was related to the drug?" You know, so we just kind of went on and on with those different things. I was telling someone this morning about the first radio show that I ever, one of the very first ones that I ever did. I had a lady call me afterwards, and she was just as mad as she could be. She said, "How dare you say anything about Prozac?" That's when that one was the only one that was out. And she said, "I don't know how I could live without that drug. It saved my life," and on and on and on and on. She told me that she'd been on it about 4 years. And I thought, uh-oh, this lady's in trouble. You're not on it for 4 years without really having some problems. And I thought, just let her talk. So I did. And for about 30 minutes, she told me how she and her husband were very, very religious.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a minute, and we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Ann Blake Tracy, who is, of course, a PhD and has written extensively about the danger of these drugs. In fact, her book, Prozac, Panacea, or Plague, and we don't carry it. I think maybe we should, because it sounds to me like a very important book. But she was talking to this one woman who was really just furious that she had been critical of Prozac. This woman talked to her for 30 minutes about how wonderful this had been, how much it had helped her. And so go ahead with that story, Dr. Blake.
Okay. She laid a background of a very religious couple, very upstanding in the community, they had hoped and prayed for a child. Finally, 8 years into their marriage, they had this beautiful little girl, and their whole lives were just centered around this little girl. So that was the background she laid over that amount of time, and told me quite a bit about them. And then, just out of the blue, she finally said, "Well, you know, it does really bother me that I've started shoplifting and I just can't stop, and I've got my 10-year-old daughter helping me." And you could hear, she said, and I don't know what to do. I was at the grocery store the other day, and I was trying to put the grocery cart in the trunk of my car. Like, you know, how stupid is that? Is the way she was saying it. And she said, a fellow just came up and took the cart from me and said, "I'm sorry, but you can't do that." And she said it so disappointed, like, can't anyone see how bad I am? Can't they help? You know, like, she wanted somebody to help, but she didn't know how to admit how bad she was. And you could hear the little girl in the background saying, "Mommy, shh, Mommy, shh." Because the poor little kids almost have to become a parent to their parents who are having so many problems.
And it really just changes their whole function of the brain. And so she was become a kleptomaniac. She was taking Prozac at the time?
Well, that's one of the manias. That's just it. We have dipsomania, which is drinking alcohol, craving alcohol. There's pyromania, where they start fires. Remember I said arson is a symptom of high serotonin levels. You've got the kleptomania, where they steal constantly. Had a woman in Seattle on one of these that embezzled $3.4 million from Starbucks. She spent every penny of it, went out, bought like 40 cars and bought all kinds of stuff. She just had it stacked in her house. There was this little path, all these boxes just stacked from floor to ceiling, little path through her house. She never used them. She just bought everything. But, you know, that's common. But what was really sad in this case was the woman, after she shooed her daughter out of the room and you heard the door shut, she then cupped her hand over the phone like this and said, "Isn't it terrible? I don't want her anymore."
Well, I'm sure that this really
does. She was doing really good on her drugs.
Well, we're going to talk to Mike from Santa Cruz, and our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you have a question, go ahead, Mike. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, a question. I'd like to thank Dr. Tracy for her book, which I read a number of years ago. And on page 319, she discusses briefly Dr. Cameron and Alan Dulles, CIA. I wonder if she could elaborate a little further on their interest, you describe it, inhuman torturous research into mind control.
Okay.
Would you mind going into that a bit?
Dr. Tracy?
No, I don't mind.
Go ahead.
It's really kind of scary to look at when you look at all the different mind control projects, and Dr. Cameron was a monster, by the way. But when you look at the
Was he the Canadian or what?
Yes.
All right, fine. He was the one who did those terrible experiments and working for the CIA, for the Central Intelligence Agency, and destroyed people's minds. There was Journey into Darkness, I think, is a book somebody had written who'd been one of his victims. But, of course, these were all government experiments. But go ahead, Dr. Tracy. I think that's so important people understand
terrible.
The government experiments to find out how terrible these things were, and then now they're prescribing them for all people.
Exactly. I know I was telling someone this morning, all you have to do is make a visit to Dachau or Auschwitz to know exactly what was going on. They were medical experimental labs, and yet we have them here in this country all over, everywhere. we just pay people to go and offer them free drugs if they'll come in. We don't call them Dachau or Auschwitz. We should. But anyway, what most people don't know is that the CIA took 80% of their initial budget when they were first organized, put it in a brown paper bag, sent two agents to Switzerland to buy up all of the LSD that Sandoz Pharmaceutical had. Sandoz was growing LSD from ergot fungus. So when they got there, the supply was not very large. So they were really disappointed that there were only a couple ounces or so. And they grabbed their brown paper bag and headed back to America, straight to Eli Lilly, the makers of Prozac. And they told Lilly that they needed LSD in a synthetic form in order to use it for a mind control agent. Lilly sent them a memo saying that they could deliver it by the truckload. And then began the experimentation by the CIA on unsuspecting members of the public who had, you know, just had no clue.
Now, these SSRI drugs work something
very much
like LSD does? Does LSD raise the serotonin levels?
Yes, it does. Okay. That's how it produces its effects. That's how PCP produces its effects, is by increasing serotonin.
See, most people don't understand the relationship. They don't understand the relationship between these, you know, the LSD and PCP. So many people are putting their children onto Ritalin because the doctors say it's good and the school nurses say
it's good. Have no idea. It's like meth.
Right. It works through the same pathways as methamphetamine.
Right. And your chemical name is methylphenidate.
Right.
How hard is that to figure out?
Well, you see, nobody's talking. In fact, we've been trying to get Dr. Peter Bregan on here to talk about Ritalin. But let's stick with the Prozac, because that's your field. And how long has your book been out now at the present time?
The first edition came out in 1994.
So you've been at this for a long time. You've been at it for at least 13 years.
And when I started, I thought it would take a year, maybe two, to turn it around. I thought surely people would wake up, because it's so simple to understand when you look at the science. But Dr. Candace Pert, one of the two discoverers of the serotonin binding process that made all of this possible, came out against them a decade ago, calling them monsters, that she's alarmed she ever had anything to do with their development. And she's not just anybody. She headed the brain chemistry department at the National Institute of Health for 13 years. And we have just totally ignored her.
And is she still speaking out against this?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, maybe off the air I can get her telephone number from you and we can get her on, too, because I'd like to get the four-tape set, which is what we do with these things, so that people can really hear various views about that. Well, anything else you want to say, Mike, before we let you go?
I want to ask if she knew if Ken Kesey was a participant in the CIA mind control experiments or the LSD experimentation.
I don't know.
Ken Kesey, of course, had written a book called One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And did Kesey die? I think I had a feeling he had died.
I think he's...
why don't you look that up on the...
Yeah, I just watched the documentary, but it was a 10-year-old documentary. So
why don't you go ahead and check that out and let me know the first week, okay?
the story is given by Thomas Wolfe Jr. in the book Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which I unfortunately read back in the late 60s. But anyhow, he talks about participating, I believe, where he was attending college. He participated in a program where they were giving experimental drugs, and took off from there. I just wondered what else they might have done to spur him on that might not have been in the book. But anyhow, part of my interest in Dr. Cameron was simply that I think the listeners should know that this was the head of the American Psychiatric Association for a time.
Amen to that.
That's where they're coming from.
Right. Thanks so
much,
Mike.
Okay, thanks, Ken.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Rick from Texas. Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
Hi, fine. I wanted to ask what the active ingredient in the SSRIs is.
What is the active ingredient in the SSRI? Do we know?
Well, we know that the active ingredient in Prozac is fluoride.
That's what I thought, fluoride. How much is it? The average capsule, I mean, or dose.
I don't know. I'd have to go back and look, but it's fluoxetine hydrochloride. So,
and, of course, that's what, remember, they're putting the fluoride in our drinking water all across the country because they're really so concerned about children's teeth.
Right.
Doesn't it collect in your bones?
Yeah, sure it does.
Yes, it does.
Does it also collect in your brain or not?
Yeah, in your pineal gland.
Yes,
we know
it does.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. We got a real problem, Rick, and people think that anybody who talks like this has got to be crazy. Well, the trouble is I'm afraid we're not. These are real problems, and we haven't talked to Dr. Tracy for some time, and I appreciate so much her sending me an email and encouraging me to have her on again. Anything else you'd like to say?
Well, I got at least 3 family members on these things. And
well, get them off.
I'm trying to.
All right, fine. Well, you know, get
make sure you get them off the right way.
And, in fact, how could people get hold of your book, Dr. Tracy? In fact, we would really like to carry your book, and I will be calling you afterwards and find out how to get it. But how do you have a website people can go to?
Drugawareness.org. Drugawareness.org.
Drugawareness.org.
Or you can call 800-280-0730.
Did you get that?
280-0730.
Okay, Rick.
Okay, thanks. It's
and but because you get a copy of a tape of our program, and if you get them just to listen to the tape, maybe, who knows, maybe they might even start listening on a regular basis.
Yeah, well, I got another one of my family members listening to you, so that's good.
Okay, God bless. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Ed calling from Utica. Hi. Hi, Ed. How you doing?
Hello, Dr. Stan. Enjoy your program. This is a very important program for me, I believe. I have a son that is in a psychiatric center, and he's on Zyprexol, and I don't know what the dangers are of that.
Do you know anything about that specific drug, Dr. Tracy?
Axel?
No. What is the drug again, Ed?
Zyprexol.
Zyprexol.
Oh, Zyprexa. Jeez. Yeah, they're ending up in a lot of trouble right now for causing so much diabetes.
Oh, yes.
How old is your son?
He's in his late 40s.
And
is he manic or what is he? Is he schizophrenic or what? Depressed?
Well, they consider him that, but I don't really see where they come up with this.
What do they call him specifically?
Well, they call him schizophrenic, paranoid schizophrenic, but I don't think he is.
Did he take antidepressants?
He is not taking anything other than that. He's forced to take this.
But before, was he on a Prozac or Luvax?
No, he was not.
He was not, huh?
He was not? Did he use street drugs?
No.
Or did he have, was he exposed to chemicals in his job or anything? Was he a painter, maybe, or?
I don't see where there's the problem in that area.
No, of course, Dr. Tracy is looking for some sort of a toxicity that
might
have precipitated the schizophrenia.
I would ask is if there's any blood sugar problems in the family, if there's any diabetes or alcoholism that would indicate low blood sugar.
Well, he is not. He doesn't drink alcohol. He's not
on
drugs.
Is anyone else in the family?
Pardon me?
anyone else in the family line that would indicate a weak pancreas running through the line?
I don't think so.
Anyone else in the family have psychiatric problems? Because that sometimes there is genetic tendency towards schizophrenia.
Well, there is maybe a touch of that in the extended family. I don't think, though, that he really has what they're telling him.
Well, I really can't comment, from a distance.
Right.
I sympathize with you. I really wouldn't know what to tell you, all the way back there
in
Utica, in Ark.
Yeah.
Have you seen Dr. Stan? Have you seen... I included a study in my book that's an addition, this last 2001 edition, where they said, well, we've known for decades that all mental illness is blood sugar related. I know as I continued to read the studies, I kept going, they're talking about blood sugar all the way through here. Finally, I ran across that study where they just, well, by the way, we've always known. Have you ever noticed that before?
No, I really have. In fact, I really need to get a copy of your book. I think it's...
The brain does not function without normal blood sugar levels.
I'm sure it doesn't, and certainly it has to have, proper nutrition. Proper nutrition is the key to so much of what's going on. Ed, you could always give me a call off the air, and I could give you some other suggestions, but... Anyway, God bless. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stan, Dr. Tracy.
Well, we'll be back. Our guest has been Ann Blake Tracy, and we're going to we'll be back in just a moment here. We have one more caller. Hi, Jack. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, Dr. Stan. You in the past mentioned Dr. David Graham of the FDA stating, I think, in a congressional testimony that the FDA cannot be trusted to fulfill its prescribed duties. And then...
I don't know if that was the exact terminology that he used, but Dr. David Graham actually testified before the Senate on Vioxx, and he was in charge of determining its safety. And if people go up to my webpage, they can actually go back and they can find Dr. David Graham's complete testimony before the investigating committee of the Senate, where he just talked about how when he tried to bring out the fact that Vioxx was not safe, that at least 60,000 Americans would die from this, how he was, of course, treated by the people, his superiors at the FDA, and, of course, now, of course, Merck has agreed to settle the Vioxx claims for $4.5 trillion, something like that. Pardon me, $4.5 billion. But you're absolutely right that Dr. Graham did refer to the fact that certainly that the people at the FDA seem to have a different agenda. So go right ahead.
Are you both sitting down?
Right.
You ready for this one?
Go ahead.
I just got the stats showing that Viagra is causing heart attacks at 5 times the rate of Vioxx.
Well, that will certainly a lot of fellows will be happy to hear that. Anyway, anything else, Jack?
What a way to go, huh?
Simply asking Dr. Tracy if Candace Perth, if she's testified to Congress, and this would be in the congressional record, I presume.
Who are you speaking of?
I don't believe Candace Pert has when it comes to antidepressants.
Well, now, who is Candace Pert?
She was one of the two discoverers of the serotonin binding process.
All right, fine. She's the woman you were speaking of earlier. Okay, Jack, we will try to get Candace onto our program.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night, and thanks so much. That was Jack calling from Michigan, and, of course, our guest this evening, Dr. Ann Blake Tracy, who's been at this, standing on the wall trying to say, don't you know what you're doing with Prozac? And of course, most people don't know what they're doing with Prozac. The doctors like it because the patients, a lot of them will feel better, but what happens down the line for the patient who continues taking Prozac over a long period of time? And nobody asked that question. Dr. Tracy, I'm going to call you back and get you onto some of my other programs, and I really appreciate your courage in what you do.
Well, thank you. You want one parting statement about these dangers? Male fish are being born with ovaries because of the huge amount of antidepressants in the water supply.
I mean, the fish are being...
Male fish are being born with ovaries.
Because of the antidepressants in the water supply.
Right.
Well, I'm sure that it's having a terrible effect, and of course, my work, much of it deals with population control. There really is an agenda to do harm to the people, and we can't depend upon the CDC, the NIH, or the FDA to protect us. God bless you, Dr. Tracy. Will you be around tomorrow?
I will.
I'll give you a call, and we'll arrange some other programs. Thanks so very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, fine. That was Dr. Ann Blake Tracy, and I hope you've enjoyed our conversation with her, talking about the dangers of Prozac. And we've talked to her in years past, and we've, of course, did a lot of programs on Ritalin in the past, and certainly hadn't been able to get a hold of Dr. Peter Bracken, who's our consultant on that. I just talked to his office the other day. Hope we can get him on, and hope we can get more in the way of interviews with Dr. Tracy and Blake Tracy, because you have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, you are responsible for your health. Nobody else can be made responsible, and the doctors are not allowed to hear programs like you've heard tonight. But we do know that there's tremendous increase in the incidence of homicidal activity. In fact, most of these multiple killers, whether it would be the boys at Columbine, I know we know one of them was on Luvox, which is a kissing cousin to Prozac, a serum serotonin inhibitor, and they won't tell us whether the other boy was on them as well. But they have these ideologies of committing these terrible homicidal deeds, and this is well known to be associated with these medications. It doesn't matter if 90% of the people feel better. If 10% or 5% or 2% are going to be suicidal or homicidal, they're just not safe to turn loose on the population, unless, of course, you want school shootings, if you want this sort of thing. And I'd like to suggest you know a better way to destroy a nation, and oh my goodness, we've got to take the guns away from everybody because somebody on Luvox or Prozac went out and shot some people. We have a real problem in our society, because we have people who look at the world entirely differently. Certainly, if you have a four-tape set on Ritalin, if you'd like to get it, we have a four-tape set on Project Monarch, the CIA mind control programs. It's really very, very fascinating. We certainly have books, one by Jim Keith, who died under very mysterious circumstances, a book called Mass Control, another one called Mind Control. We have a four-tape set on mind control, interviews with Mark Phillips and Kathy O'Brien, and they were the ones who introduced me to Hugh and Cameron. I've never met him personally. He's passed away and gone to his just reward. But Hugh and Cameron was the head of the American Psychiatric Association, who did a number of experiments in Canada on people who just come into his office with depression and put them in the hospital and give them multiple electric shocks under a contract from the CIA just to see what would happen, and destroyed the minds of people who have no memory of anything at all. Experiments, and eventually, of course, when the information came out why some of the people were able to get settlements from the Canadian government, the book Journey into Madness goes into the background of this. We don't carry the book. You can get it on Amazon.com. You need to know some of the terrible experiments they've done on American citizens. Without their knowledge or consent, we do have the Rockefeller Committee report, which touches on that, came out of the Veterans Administration over the name of Jay Rockefeller. Well, ladies and gentlemen, our telephone number, if you'd like more information, 1-800-544-8927, the two four-tape sets, one on Ritalin, one on Mind Control, the books Mass Control and Mind Control, and then please pray for America, pray for revival, pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, my ministry, for our provision and our protection. And we'll be back in just a moment here for the second hour. Stand back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for this next hour, they're going to be the views of one of my favorite guests, William Grigg. And William Grigg was, for many years, one of the senior editors of the New American magazine. And fortunately, he's now, of course, working with the Welch Foundation is willing to come on with us. We'd like to get him on a couple of times a week. He's been a little under the weather recently. How are you feeling tonight, William?
I'm feeling a little bit better. If my voice falters on occasion, please forgive me. I'm still not completely out of the woods.
Well, I'm having the same problem. Of course, I'm taking something called Allibiotic and vitamin D and large doses of that, and I'm on the uphill side, but I know how miserable that is when you get it. Anyway, so what are we going to talk about this evening?
You and I have discussed on several occasions the case of Jose Padilla, who was that Chicago-born, actually I think he was Brooklyn-born, but Chicago resident who had been sent to prison a number of years ago as a street gangster. He'd been a gangbanger of sort of a small caliber type, and while he was in prison, he was converted to radical Islam, as so many people are in our prison system. And at some point, he went to Egypt, I believe it was 1998, and he got involved with some people who were, I think, sort of gamey, radical Muslim activists, and he allegedly went to Afghanistan. Anyhow, he's the fellow who in 2002, with great fanfare, was arrested as he was returning to O'Hare Airport, and Attorney General Ashcroft was in Moscow at the time, appropriately enough, and he made a very dramatic, breathless press conference to announce the arrest of Jose Padilla, who is supposedly an Al-Qaeda operative involved in a plot to detonate a radiological bomb somewhere in the United States. And immediately thereafter, Jose Padilla was designated an enemy combatant by presidential decree, and he was sent to a brig in South Carolina, where he was held for, I believe it was 3 years and 8 months, and for most of that time, no contact with legal counsel, none of the due process protections that are afforded to criminal defendants or criminal suspects in our system. He's somebody who was never formally charged with any crime having to do with that dirty bomb plot, although last year he was convicted of a more nebulous charge of supporting terrorism overseas on the basis of evidence that was very dubious at best. The basis of his conviction was that there were a number of intercepted communications, telephone communications between Padilla and some of his associates, that government experts insisted contained coded messages about their terrorist ambitions for instance, when they discussed eggplant, they weren't talking about food, they were talking about explosives, supposedly. When they talked about football, they were talking about murder, things of this sort. And the jury bought the idea that there was this coded communication going on, and they signed off on the credibility of the government witnesses. But the point is, he was never convicted. But he was never convicted of any of the crimes, the supposed plots, for which he was incarcerated for 3 years and 8 months. And during that time, he was subjected to what we would have to consider to be physical and psychological torture, sensory deprivation, for instance, manipulation of extremes of temperature, sleep deprivation. Sleep deprivation alone is enough to break one's mind. If you keep somebody awake for a week, he becomes a mental vegetable. Stress positions. He was kept in a sub-medieval dungeon cell without so much as a blanket, a sheet, or a pillow, sleeping on a bare metal cot, and kept awake at night, and threatened on numerous occasions with physical harm or death. Or
hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment.
Mr. Padilla was threatened with all kinds of physical harm, including the prospect of being exported overseas to a country or be treated even worse. And yeah, all this was done to this American citizen, this U.S. citizen. He was somebody, once again, for whom I don't have any brief as an individual. He had been a street gangster, a street criminal. He was a veteran of our prison system, where he became a radical Muslim. But there's no evidence that he was ever a terrorist, and no evidence to this day, really, his conviction notwithstanding, that he ever did anything by way of plotting terrorism in this country. Well, the point of this, the story that we've talked about, that I think deserves elucidation in a deeper way this evening, is that as a U.S. citizen, Mr. Padilla was declared somebody beyond the protection of the law. His habeas corpus rights were denied to him by virtue of being declared an enemy combatant, and his mind was essentially destroyed. There was a deliberate effort, according to one of the officials who talked with the Christian Science Monitor about this. There was a deliberate effort to ruin Jose Padilla's mind. Now, failing in the effort, I believe, to turn him into an informant or a provocateur, which was probably what they were after, according to an FBI agent who testified in his trial in Miami, Padilla was being pressured into becoming an informant, which probably means he'd be the person who would precipitate a supposed plot on behalf of the government. Failing to do that, the government set out to destroy this guy's mind. The reason I go into detail describing what was done to Mr. Padilla is to act as sort of an elaborate preface for this piece of news, which I find rather heartening. The Yale University Human Rights Clinic, which is a group of professors and attorneys who are involved in pro bono legal activism, have filed a lawsuit on behalf of Jose Padilla and Jose Padilla's mother, a woman by the name of Estela LeBron, against John C. Yu. Now, that's a person, the name of which is unfamiliar to most Americans, but he's an immensely consequential person. John C. Yu is a young man, I think he's in his late 30s or early 40s, who is presently teaching at the law school at the University of California, Berkeley. Until, I believe, 2006, Mr. Yu was employed in the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department under Attorney General Ashcroft, and then under Attorney General Gonzalez, I believe. Actually, Gonzalez, I think, took over in 2007. But Mr. Yu was in charge of the team that wrote a number of key memos asserting broad and unchallengeable powers on the part of the president in the context of warfare and in the context of the supposed effort to protect our country from terrorism.
Hold that thought right there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is William Grigg. And William, we've been talking about Jose Padilla, who was this street gangbanger who actually had been sent to prison, had converted to the Muslim faith, had gone overseas, had gotten involved with the Muslims there, and then was arrested very early in the year 2002 and charged with being part of a plot to set off a dirty bomb. Now, he was kept in prison for 3 years with that. He was not given the right of habeas corpus. Everything was done to destroy his mind. He was kept in isolation. He was kept in solitary. Things done to manipulate the temperature. And they really psychologically destroyed his mind. That's the sort of thing you'd expect in a communist prison camp, but not in an American prison. And, of course, then... he was eventually convicted. They got the jury. They tell him about all the terrible crimes about terrorism, and of course they had some telephone conversations he'd made where he talked about eggplant, and well, they said eggplant meant explosives.
Yeah.
And they said that he talked about other things, football. Oh, well, that meant some other sort of nefarious activity, and they convinced the jury that he was a full-blown terrorist, and I think he was sent to prison for the rest of his life. But now, of course, there is a group of lawyers who filed an appeal on his part, the part of his mother, to try to get what was done to Mr. Padilla evaluated by the courts. Because believe me, when the federal government comes after you with all the tremendous power that they have, and they focus all of their lawyers and all of their witnesses, and they can get people to say anything on the witness stand, believe me. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. You can get up and lie on the witness stand. Nothing's ever going to happen to you. And they were able emotionally to get the jury to convict Jose Padilla. But anyway, William, now tell us about this lawsuit that's been filed, an appeal for Padilla.
Well, it's not an appeal. There is an appeal of his conviction. He was convicted in a criminal trial in Miami, along with a couple of people he may or may not have had a whole lot to do with. I mean, at least one of the people who was convicted with, if I remember correctly, one of his co-defendants who was convicted alongside of Padilla was somebody with whom he had been in contact and knew very, very casually. And it was the conversations by telephone and, I guess, by email between these two that provided the centerpiece of the case, the criminal case against them, such as it was. They would talk about their kids, they'd talk about cooking, they'd talk about sports, and this was transmuted through the alchemy of federal expert witness testimony into plots to blow up unspecified people overseas. But in the case of that conviction, there is an appeal. This is a separate legal action being undertaken by this group of attorneys from Yale University for the purpose of trying to extract some kind of civil liability from John C. Yu.
Now, he used to work for the White House. He was an advisor from the Justice Department?
Yeah, the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department. John C. Yu was the fellow who was the chief academic architect of the Bush administration's doctrine of the supreme and sovereign executive. He's written a couple of books on the subject, The Powers of War and Peace, and the other one I can't remember the title of. But his thesis is basically that the powers of the president in the context of warfare are fundamentally illimitable unless Congress is willing literally to shut down through defunding the war effort, simply stripping the war effort of funding. Absent that kind of radical intervention by the Congress, the president can do anything he wants to do. In John C. Yu's intellectual universe, the president of the United States basically has the power to do as much as he can get away with. Now, in practical terms, that's true. As long as people are willing to let a president act with impunity, he can do anything he wants. The Constitution, however, does not authorize the president to do so. This is pure usurpation when a president, for instance, on his own supposed authority, commits our country to a foreign war without a congressional declaration. The president is guilty of usurpation. John C. Yu, on the other hand, says that the president has the constitutional power to do that unless Congress intervenes to stop it. And so, from his point of view, basically, the powers of the presidency are plenary and self-existing, whereas the Constitution makes the powers of the president to be derivative and wholly contingent. The president is basically the executive of the constitutionally appropriate will of the Congress in just about everything that he does. There are very few things a president can do that do not represent, in some sense, him working as an agent on behalf of the Congress. He's the executive of the laws to see that they are faithfully executed is his sole purpose and privilege under the Constitution. But John C. Yu, through these memos that he wrote beginning in September 2001, laid out a doctrine in which the president basically can do anything he wants to anybody, anytime, for any reason that he deigns to do it. And he's also the author, the ghostwriter of the identified author was Jay Bybee, a fellow who was a superior, I believe, in the Office of Legal Counsel to John C. Yoo. But John C. Yoo is the uncredited author of the so-called Bybee Memorandum, which laid out the legal case for torture and the legal doctrines immunizing those who carry out torture on behalf of the president. Basically, the idea is that there is some kind of commander-in-chief power. That's the phrase that was used in that memorandum written by you and signed by Bybee. There's this commander-in-chief power that is infinitely divisible and completely unassailable. And if you act as the agent of the commander-in-chief in carrying out torture, which in that memorandum was defined as basically anything short of causing organ failure, meaning heart failure, if you carry out torture, then you are effectively immunized as an agent of the president in doing so, and you can't be held criminally or civilly liable. And it was also you who helped draft the memo on behalf of then White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, talking about the inapplicability of the Geneva Conventions to people who are being detained as suspected terrorists or as irregular combatants in the war on terror. So here's the guy who is basically the chief architect of the entire legal doctrine of the imperial executive and the denial of individual due process rights or guarantees for people who were detained on presidential orders. And Jose Padilla was the victim of this entire campaign, in the sense that everything that was done to Jose Padilla is a direct outgrowth of the doctrines that were devised by John Yoo. And reading here from the lawsuit, the attorneys writing on behalf of Padilla make the following case. The grave violations suffered by Padilla were not isolated occurrences by rogue lower-level officials. To the contrary, defendant John Yoo, along with other senior officials, deliberately removed Mr. Padilla from due process protections traditionally available to U.S. citizens detained by their government and barred all access to the outside world, including access to counsel. Excuse me here. Defendant Yoo personally provided numerous legal memoranda that purported to provide to senior government officials a legal basis to implement an extreme and unprecedented interrogation and detention program, even though such tactics are unprecedented in U.S. history and clearly contrary to the U.S. Constitution and the law of war. And then for 24 pages, they outline, delineate a number of the things that were done to Mr. Padilla as part of this campaign. First of all, to get him to incriminate himself through psychological manipulation, psychological duress and torture, and then physical torture, and then basically to deprive him of his ability to be an independent, rational actor. And the purpose of this lawsuit is to identify the tortious abuses that were inflicted on this U.S. citizen during the course of a 3-year, 8-month detention, during which he was never charged with a crime. He had no access to counsel, no way to challenge the conditions of his detention. He essentially served a 3-year, 8-month prison sentence under conditions that would have to be considered sub-medieval, basically because of the doctrines that were devised by John Yoo. Now, somebody has to be held responsible for this. The policymakers who are in Washington right now, in the Bush administration, are protected by the spurious doctrine of sovereign immunity, which basically says that the government can only be sued when it condescends to permit itself to be sued. But John Yoo was no longer in public service. He's now a well-compensated law professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Here's somebody who suffered definable, documentable physical and personal injury as a result of actions that John Yoo was party to. So they are going to try to make him civilly liable for this. It's a difficult thing to do because there is a presumption attached to Mr. Yoo as a former public servant, as they're so grandly styled, that he enjoys some kind of effective immunity from policy decisions and advice that he had given as a member of the Justice Department. But that's, once again, something that's testable. There are cases where people have been held responsible when they have been party to definable injury to people that is unjustified.
Now, because what about the Nuremberg trials? This was the defense that the Germans used. We were just carrying out orders, you know.
Yeah, exactly. The defense here is that they can, you know, John, you can say, well, you know, I was only following orders, and what Bush is saying basically is I was only ordering followers, and so they'd immunize each other. And if this is interesting in light of what's going on right now with the scandal about the CIA tapes, the tapes of...
They destroyed the tapes.
Yeah, exactly. Involved waterboarding, we believe, on the basis of some of the elliptical comments that have been made about the contents of those tapes. But the purpose of making those tapes, I believe, was to document and record efforts that would have been made had either of these suspects died under duress, so as to document that efforts were made to keep them alive. I think that's why they were made, and when they survived, they destroyed the tapes so as to protect the guilty. Because what was being done was illegal, irrespective of whether or not the subjects died as a result of the torture.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment here with William Grigg. And ladies and gentlemen, could these things happen in America? Yes, they could happen. And men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. What are you doing?
I think one of the really interesting possibilities about this whole controversy involving the destruction of those CIA interrogation and torture tapes, now that we know that the Bush administration is supporting Attorney General Mukasey's inquiry, I believe what's going on right now is they're looking for some place to stick the responsibility so that it doesn't get above a certain pay grade. That's what happened with Abu Ghraib. There were a handful of people, some people who were the low-hanging fruit of the recruitment orchard, who were sort of gathered up from prisons and county jails in West Virginia and places of that sort, and sent over to Iraq to be MPs at Abu Ghraib. They're the ones who are held responsible for the torture and humiliation, degradation, and occasionally, you know, outright murder of Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib, in spite of the fact that it definitely was a case where an environment was created through policies that were handed down from Rumsfeld's office that resulted in what happened in Abu Ghraib. But they managed to contain the scandal down to the level of the corporals and the sergeants and the captains. And I think that a similar dynamic is at work now with the CIA investigation. They want to make sure that when the music stops, the people left without chairs will be relatively low-level folks who are carrying out policies that have been handed down. And often, they were carrying out these policies with the explicit assurance that they would not face any kind of civil or criminal liability. One of the purposes of the Military Commissions Act, incidentally, and the Detainee Treatment Act, those measures were passed a little more than almost a year and a half ago, for, among other purposes, the objective of retroactively legalizing and immunizing the policymakers and some of the people who carried out the policies that resulted in the torture of detainees. But that being said, there's still, of course, the prospect of civil liability or political liability, and I think that at this point the Bush administration is actively supporting the investigation so it can shepherd it in a direction away from excuse me, from Bush and the rest of his cohorts at the top. And so when you start looking at the type of people who were involved in this and the type of liabilities that exist, I think the lawsuit here against John Yoo is actually an encouraging development in that whether or not this guy actually gets hit with a great big judgment, the lawsuit itself is going to be supremely unpleasant to the guy, and hopefully it will also conduce to some personal and professional unpleasantness for the individual, too. It would be terrific to see him being ostracized, if not vilified, as a war criminal. He's in a profession where the professional reputation means a lot of the individual. I mean, he's a law professor. He travels in circles where he has to be dealt with as a peer by people, some of whom at least, do take seriously the idea that the law is supposed to protect individual rights. I would hope that there would be enough people in that profession who would make John Yoo very, very miserable in his academic and social circles, and put as much pressure both legally and professionally on the guy as possible. Squeeze him as hard as you can until maybe he'll disclose a couple of things that we could use in additional lawsuits against other people who were involved in this.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment with William Grigg here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is William Grigg, and we're talking about the lawsuit that's been lodged against John Yoo, who was worked in the Justice Department and wrote a series of memos to justify torture. He said, in essence, that the president can do whatever he wants to. In wartime, there are no restrictions, and that certainly torture was acceptable. Well, there are a group of lawyers, and I guess these are good guys, are concerned about the basic precept that has been established, because if they got away with the Padilla, they could get away with it with anybody in the listening audience. And so the suit is being brought against John Yoo for, now, he no longer works for the government, so
no.
He no longer has that government immunity. You know, they can say, well, he works for the government, he's covered. Now, they may say, well, he has retroactive immunity. But anyway, this is going to dramatize this, and of course, as William says, you know, in the law profession, especially when you're teaching in the university, if you are one of those rare people who thinks that mistreatment of human beings and torture is perfectly all right, you're going to be a rarity. In fact, William is saying that he really hopes that the people who work with Mr. Yoo will be letting him know that under no circumstances do they condone what he did. He may just say, well, I was simply carrying out orders. Well, that's, of course, what the Germans said.
Sure.
In the Nuremberg trials. I was just carrying out orders. So I think that's a rather exciting thing to contemplate. William, it's going to be interesting to see how that lawsuit goes.
Well, yeah, one of the things that happens when you're trying to roll up a criminal syndicate is you find the weakest of the available links, and you work that link until it snaps. And hopefully what happens in the investigation, for instance, of an organized crime unit, an organized crime cell, is you find somebody who's willing to turn on the others. And what I'm hoping is that John Yoo will prove to be as pliant under the morally appropriate pressure of his professional colleagues and also the lawsuit that's been filed today against him, that he'll make some key disclosures as well. You've got to think that there are people you could inculpate in definable crimes against the Constitution and against individual human beings. And here, once again, in the person of Jose Padilla, you've got a U.S. citizen. You've got a U.S. citizen who's not a very good U.S. citizen, but he's somebody who still was protected by the Constitution, or at least should have been. And so you've got somebody who has standing to sue. That's one of the most important considerations here, is that when you're dealing with the type of people who find themselves in circumstances like Padilla's, those are often people who don't have any standing to sue, and Mr. Padilla and his mother certainly do. And once you put pressure on somebody like John Yoo, you might be able to roll them over and get them to start making other key disclosures that can fuel congressional investigations or fuel additional lawsuits, or perhaps even criminal charges could result from this.
In other words, John, you could simply say, well, I was ordered, I was told what they wanted me to say, I shouldn't have done it, but I certainly compromised my principles and wrote a directive to excuse my superiors for what they were doing. But it was their fault, not mine. And certainly that could very well be the case, you know. And
of course, John,
you have a feeling that he's probably been very well rewarded. I mean, how many people go at a very young age from being a clerk, working for the Justice Department, to becoming a professor at a law school? He's obviously being rewarded for what he did and for being quiet.
My understanding is that you clerked in the Supreme Court office as Clarence Thomas before going into the Office of Legal Counsel there under Ashcroft. And he's somebody who is attached to the Federalist Society. And I had once upon a time, back when I was a little bit even more foolish than I am now, thought the Federalist Society was a good outfit because my perception was they were actually devoted to federalism, the idea that you'd have a separation of powers and overlapping concurrent jurisdictions, the idea that the federal government would have a very limited role, the states would have the predominant role in the management of the daily affairs of the people, things of this sort. In other words, federalism is defined in the Federalist Papers. Well, the Federalist Society in practice has been basically the Society for Presidential Supremacy. And most of the people attached to the Federalist Society who go on to become pundits or policymakers have this hyper-Nixonian view of the privileges of the White House and the Oval Office, and you pretty much embodies that, and we see where it leads.
I see, and it leads to, well, it can lead to torture. We'll be back here in just a minute. You can justify anything. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grigg, and we were just talking about the Federalist Society, and I'll have to admit, William, I had the same feeling there, that the Federalist Society was a good organization, and I knew some of the people in it, but then I began to see that it was not really what it purported to be. It wasn't in favor of the federalism that our founding fathers were, not at all. They wanted a federalism like Benito Mussolini wanted federalism, yeah, with all power with the state. And that is a dangerous precept, which is the antithesis of our form of government. So you go right ahead.
I think one of the things that happened is that when the Federalist Society, as it styles itself, got going, I believe it was in the mid to late 80s, there was this sense that the powers of the presidency had been somewhat shortchanged, and that Congress had become excessively powerful. And, you know, I remember there was a book that came out when I was in Washington. I was in Washington in 87 and 88, Washington, D.C., and I tell people that the longest decade of my life was the 6 or 8 months that I was in Washington, D.C. But there was a book called The Imperial Congress, I believe it was put out by the Heritage Foundation. The idea was that the Congress was exercising disproportionate power, and that the presidency really needed to be rehabilitated, and its powers had to be strengthened, particularly in foreign affairs. And this, of course, was in the late Reagan era, and a lot of people of that persuasion became that way, and they adopted that point of view because of the experience of Watergate. They thought that this is an example of Congress criminalizing policy differences and clipping the wings of the presidency and dangerously diminishing the power of the presidency. And that attitude, I think, really took root and flourished in the Federalist Society. And the people who were sort of attached to that outfit, I think Chief Justice Roberts was a Federalist Society member, and a lot of the people, John Hughes, Kidney, were in the Federalist Society. Ann Coulter, I believe, was attached to it. They all more or less seen from the same hymn book, which is that the president is the occupant of the office who is elected by the entire body of the people, which, by the way, isn't true. He's elected by the Electoral College. And as such, he embodies the will of the people, and he should have a hand that is strengthened and formidable in foreign affairs and in dealing with America's enemies. And the thing is, none of that's true for a true description of the constitutional powers of the presidency. I mean, the president, once again, is somebody who's the chief executive.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment with William Grigg here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William was just simply talking about the Federalist Society. They seem to think, and he mentioned Justice Roberts had been associated with it, Ann Coulter, a number of young idealistic people, but they wanted an ever more powerful executive. Whereas, of course, the Constitution foresaw an executive who would carry out the dictates of Congress, but that he was not to be allowed, you know, to be an all-powerful individual. We did not, you know, separate from Great Britain to have a new king in Washington, D.C. We wanted an executive like the executive, a leader of a corporation, not a ruler like they would have in the monarchies of Europe. So you go ahead and pick up the story there.
The president's supposed to be more akin to a CEO than a monarch. And one of the things that Washington did, actually there are a couple of, many things he did that were of great importance here, but one of the first things he did, of course, after he was finished as the commander of the Continental Army, was he took off his military uniform and he never wore it again. And he could very easily have created a horrible precedent by wearing his military uniform when he was inaugurated the first president of the United States. Another thing he did, and I've mentioned this before, was he submitted to the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court in determining whether the president had the power to issue an executive order that would have the force of law. President Washington did that with respect to the neutrality policy that he wanted to enforce during the war between France and Great Britain that took place during Washington's presidency. He wanted to keep the United States out of that war, which of course was the sound policy and a good example of the virtues that Washington talked about in his farewell address. And when the Neutrality Act was violated by an individual who was trying to build and provide ships to France, Washington ordered the man's arrest, and the man challenged his arrest on the basis of the fact that there was no law forbidding him from doing what he had done. There was simply an executive order. Washington submitted this question to the Supreme Court, and John Jay, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, one of the writers, the authors of the Federalist Papers, handed down a decision basically saying that Washington had it wrong. He could not enforce an executive order as if it were a law. And so Washington asked Congress to pass a law that would have the same substance as the executive order, and that law was passed. But it wasn't applied ex post facto either. The man was released from prison. I can't remember his name, but that's a very important illustration of how a truly Federalist president would conduct himself. I mean, that's one of the definitive examples, because this happened just within a few years of our beginning as a republic, and it was a very important way of laying the predicate for what the presidency should be. Now, under George W. Bush, you have these signing statements that are used to winnow out from laws that are signed into law, you know, bills that are signed into law, to remove from these bills provisions that the president doesn't like. Basically, what he'll do is he'll sign into law a bill and then attach a signing statement that will reinterpret the law to suit his fancy. So he's taking laws and turning them into executive decrees through these signing statements. And that's an example of the sort of thing that the Federalist Society has been promoting. They've been promoting the idea that the president is a law unto himself, that the president is a living constitution. And nobody has done more to promote that evil point of view than John C. Yoo.
All right, fine. Before we go on, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your blog site, and what about your book? Is that available yet?
My book is available, although I don't have the details yet. I will have them on my blog as soon as possible. My book ships on the 17th of December. I'm still waiting to get my copies, and as soon as I've got my quantity in hand and have been able to get in touch with the people who are distributing it for the Wells Foundation, Dr. Stan, I'll make sure that you get a quantity so you can make it available to your listeners. The book is entitled Liberty and Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. And the book describes our descent into an executive-ruled, unitary military police state. We are living right now in an unprecedented state of affairs in our country, in that the assumption is our government's powers are plenary and open-ended in the context of a conflict that's going to go on into the indefinite future, and that the President of the United States and those he authorizes as his agents can do to any of us at their sole discretion what was done to Jose Padilla, which is to say arrest us, designate us people outside the protection of the law, incarcerate us for as long as they see fit to do so, treat us as they see fit to treat us, and we would have no recourse of any kind. And this book describes how this is sort of the fulfillment of several decades of movement in the direction of consolidating power in the executive branch, militarizing law enforcement, putting law enforcement under the jurisdiction and the control, the operational control of the federal government, and the institutionalization of torture. I mean, I would not have believed 5 years ago we would be having conversations debating the merits of torture as a formal policy of the federal government of the United States, that sober, serious, and supposedly Christian people would be making defenses of torture as a necessary thing, and even to the point where one commentator just a couple of days ago lamented as a sign of hopeless moral confusion the fact that there are many Americans who object to torture. You know, this is a, according to this particular commentator, the fact that Americans object to torture illustrates that Americans are hopelessly morally confused. That's how far we've gotten, and my book describes this whole sorry process in some length, and then talks about some of the ways that we can move away from the brink of the abyss here. My blog, which is entitled Pro Libertate, that's a Latin phrase that means for freedom, is available through the home webpage of the Welch Foundation, The Right Source. And the web address for that is www.rightsourceonline.com. Once again, that's www.rightsourceonline.com. One word, rightsourceonline.com. You look at the upper left-hand corner of the front page of that website, you'll see my photograph, and there is a little hyperlink inside the box containing my photograph that says View Blog. And you click on that, it'll take you to the blog. And I'm also happy to say that within the next week or so, hopefully, we're going to reactivate the long-dormant email magazine called Pro Libertate. There are two offerings we have that are labeled Pro Libertate. One is my blog, which comes out, you know, 4 to 6 times a week, and the other is an e-zine, which has longer illustrated articles and some multimedia offerings as well. And because of things that have been going on both professionally and with respect to my domestic situation, just very briefly, and in the interest of not full but adequate disclosure, my wife has been very ill. She's been in the hospital now for several months, and so I'm under the necessity now of working out of my home and maintaining a household of 5 very young children with my wife in the hospital, and with that going on and a number of other things attendant to my job piling up, I just had to put something off, hold something in abeyance, and that thing, unfortunately, has been the email magazine. But we're going to be reviving that, hopefully, in the next couple of weeks as well. But to find all this, go to www.rightsourceonline.com.
That's www.rightsourceonline.com.
Yep.
Excellent, excellent blog. All right, fine. Well, we'll go right ahead with what we were talking about. If you're out in the listening audience, you have a question for William. Our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But I share William's concern about what is going on, because we are moving away from individual liberty towards a dictatorship. And this did not start with George W. Bush.
No.
I don't think for a minute it did. Many of the pieces of legislation they've gotten through, they tried to get through after the Oklahoma City bombing, hoping that in the horror of that tragedy with 168 Americans dead, well, actually there were 169. There was one body. Nobody knows who it was, and only half of it was there. And it certainly looked like it might have been somebody from the military, but nobody ever claimed the body. We don't talk much about that. Under any circumstances, why they tried to get through this legislation, they could not get it through because Congress wouldn't vote for it. It was only then the emotion following 9/11, and then the anthrax letters, which were sent only to Democrat senators, interestingly enough, not to the Republican senators. And of course, in the shadow of the anthrax letters, they were able to get the Patriot Act through. Who could vote against patriotism? Well, I think that one congressman did, who's running for president now. There were, I think, only three or four people who voted against the Patriot Act, which was a massive extension of government control and had nothing to do with patriotism.
Mm-hmm.
Just go right ahead.
Well, that's one of the lies that we have to confront right up front here, is that we're dealing with patriotism when we're talking about enhancing the power of government. And patriotism is the love of one's country. What we're dealing with right now is a form of what we'd have to call sort of curdled and proto-totalitarian nationalism. Nationalism is not the love of one nation. In practice, what that refers to, nationalism, is the idea of identifying one's nation with one's government to the point where you believe that in order to advance the interests of your country, you necessarily have to make the government stronger. And nationalism is practiced and promoted for the last 120 or 130 years. It's been very collectivist in its outlook. The idea that the government is the natural and organic representative in all times and in all circumstances of the interests of the people, and that the government itself is embodied in a leader, whether you're talking about a president, a caudillo, a Führer, a Duce, you know, somebody who embodies the nation as a ruler, as a dear leader. That's the sort of a system we're talking about right now. It's nationalistic only in the sense that it's a unitary, unified, monolithic type of a system, but it's not nationalist in the sense of protecting necessarily the sovereignty and the individual rights of the citizens. But the legislation you were talking about, Dr. Stan, with respect to creating the Department of Homeland Security and the so-called Patriot Act. The Patriot Act, of course, was actually passed before it was written. That's one of those anomalies of American history, is that people didn't have any time to read this mammoth and very detailed bill, because it was thousands of pages long and tens of thousands of words, and a lot of it was literally filled in after the fact. But the legislation to create the Department of Homeland Security was on the desk of George W. Bush in January 2001, months before the bombing took place on September 11th. And the thing that we're finding out now is that a lot of the material that's come out about the national security state starting in 1947 shows that there has been this seamless continuity of plans for creating a homeland security apparatus by whatever name it was called, whether it was called a national security state or now homeland security. Just a week and a half ago or so, and I'm sure this is something you probably discussed, there was this disclosure about the plans that were created under FBI Director Hoover way back in 1950 to have lists of people who would be subject to detention as subversives. And, of course, a lot of these people would be, I think, quite properly considered politically subversive, in the sense that they were people who were promoting a Marxist, communist point of view. There were people, many of whom had found their way into the government bureaucracy or had insinuated themselves into various key positions in the federal government. And there were many who were radical activists whose idea of political reform would move the United States in the direction of the Soviet Union. So I obviously don't have a brief for their point of view. But if all they're doing is promoting a point of view, you don't punish them for their political outlook. And I hold to Frank Chidorov's perspective on what to do about communists and fellow travelers and the bureaucracy. Frank Chidorov was the wonderful libertarian writer of the 1940s, 1950s. Wrote a number of books. My favorite of his books is The Income Tax, The Root of All Evil. And Frank Chidorov was talking at the time of the McCarthy hearings to the subversion of various elements of the federal government. Chidorov said, well, if the problem is we have communists infesting the bureaucracy, the solution is to get rid of the bureaucracy. You know, that's my point of view exactly. I mean, not to denigrate anything that Joseph McCarthy did in terms of exposing the fact that the system was thoroughly infested with communists. Simply getting them out of the bureaucracy doesn't make our life any better. You have to get rid of the bureaucracy. But we find that there were plans as early as 1950 for the same type of system we've got right now, which would entail the envisioned roundup of hundreds of thousands of people in detention camps in the event of some kind of a catastrophic emergency. Now, what J. Edgar Hoover was talking about in 1950 had to do with the war in Korea and the possibility of that war becoming a full-blown confrontation between the United States and Soviet Russia. And now, of course, we're talking about all kinds of scenarios involving, for instance, radiological or other nuclear terrorism in the United States, an epidemic, widespread disaster, an attack by a nuclear-armed rogue state. There are all kinds of scenarios that one could talk about. The typical scenario now with respect to the defense of these camps that are being created by Halliburton Corporation is the need to round up for deportation the illegal immigrants who are living in our country. And I don't think that's particularly a high priority for the government in Washington, D.C. They've never shown a whole lot of interest in that. So it's obviously a pretext for something else. They want to do something else with those detention facilities. But what I find remarkable, once again, is the fact that over a half a century ago, there were plans being discussed, which are just now coming to light, that would envision the wide-scale detention of American citizens. And if it takes, 57 or 58 years for that sort of a detail to be brought out for public inspection, it's worth speculating right now as to what's going on behind the scenes of Washington, what plans are being discussed, what contingencies are being prepared that we won't know about until they're actually sprung on the public.
And I certainly share your concern. I think the fact that Halliburton is being paid $385 million a year to be standing by to build concentration camps. They're not building them. They're just paid to stand by to be ready to build them at any moment. And, of course, on a four-year contract. If you haven't seen the articles, we have them here at Radio Liberty. We'll make them available to you. And ladies and gentlemen, then of course they're going to refurbish the old Japanese concentration camps, all 10 of them, so that we'll never forget how terrible it was to put American citizens in concentration camps. But if that's really their concern, then why are they planning to build new concentration camps? Who are they for? Well, we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program with William Grigg, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
I am sort of guardedly optimistic about a couple of things. I do think that the lawsuit against John Yoo is an encouraging development in the sense that it might put pressure on him to disclose more useful information that will sort of accelerate the process of exposing the people who were involved in turning our government into an engine of detention, tyranny, and torture. And I do think that there is a growing and very healthy backlash, a sense of outraged revulsion over what's been going on in many of the elements of the Bush administration's policy. We are, as a people, no better than anybody else on the planet. We're all, of course, created out of the same stuff. We're all made in God's image, but we're all sinners. We're all liable to the same failings as everybody else. We are an exceptionally blessed people. I mean, there's never been a blessing to compare with that of being born in the United States or becoming an American citizen, being the beneficiary of our heritage of liberty under law. Even now, as that heritage is badly corrupted, it's still a tremendous blessing. We are a very materialistic people. We have our full suite of faults and failings. But one thing you cannot say about Americans, and that is that we are generally not indifferent to the spectacle of torture. I think finally there's been something that has triggered our cultural gag reflex, or something that has finally sent an electric shock through our conscience here about the fact that you simply cannot authorize the government to treat human beings as if they were simply animate bags of meat. And I think one of the things that might have done this might be the sudden, over the last several months, the sudden spectacle of people being tasered by police for no defensible reason. Tasering under those circumstances is a form of torture. It's a form of pain compliance. I think that might have actually had an impact on public perceptions. People look at that and think, well, it's not a good idea to treat people that way. And suddenly, when they start reading about waterboarding or stress positions or sensory deprivation or other forms of so-called coercive interrogation, their conscience has suddenly become awake. And I think that there is a beginning here of a, once again, useful sense of collective revulsion on the part of the American public, and I think we ought to cultivate that, because that might lead us in a healthier direction than we've been going.
Well, William, we're out of time, but thank you so much for being with us. I do hope that you'll get feeling better here.
Oh, thank you. I do, too.
When we will look forward then to being with you again next week.
Wonderful.
Bye-bye, and God bless. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at the Radio Liberty, and certainly we have a great deal of information going along with what we're talking about tonight. We have a four-tape set on the War Powers Act, and if any of you want, why, we have a report that put out by the Senate back in 1973 pointing to the fact that everything is in place today for the establishment of a dictatorship in America that they can actually rule, came out over the names of Senator Mathias and Senator Frank Church, but a very, very provocative, certainly material. So we certainly hope that some of you were interested in getting either the four-tape set or that report. And then, of course, we have other four-tape sets that go into the impending police state, and I believe that we are moving rapidly towards a police state here in the United States. We don't like to talk about that, but unfortunately, these things can happen. There are people who really want a different type of world. And so behind what's really going on today are powerful spiritual forces. Their goal has always been to use the power, financial and military, of the United States to bring about a world government. This, of course, is covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, in my talk on the forbidden secret, in the videos that we offer, the secret mystery of America's beginning, very, very professionally done, and then the second one in the series by Chris Pinto, entitled Riddles in Stone. We have a video, a DVD we've produced with Chris Pinto, entitled The Atlantis Connection. What does Atlantis have to do with anything? Lost Atlantis? Well, very simply, there are people within the occult who believe that America will be the new Atlantis, and we will lead the world into this one world government. That's what it's all about. And this dates back to the time of Lost Atlantis. This is the new Atlantis. And I think Chris does a very, very good job in this talk called The Atlantis Connection. And then, of course, there's not only going to be a new world order and a new world religion, there's going to be a new world leader. Who is he going to be? Well, Constance Cumby covers that in her excellent DVD entitled The Emergence. The Emergence, we have that. And, of course, we have a four-tape set, a four-CD set with Constance, which, of course, is called The Wisdom of Constance Cumby, or just ask for the Constance Cumby 4 interview set, and fascinating material which will show you how these occult societies have permeated every aspect of our lives. Most people don't realize they're here, but they're working in our schools, they're working in our government, they're working in our industries, they're working, you know, in our hospitals. They're influencing every aspect of our lives. So that 4-tape or 4-CD set on by Constance Cumby, I think, is very, very important. And then, of course, we have a 4-tape set or 4-CD set called The Supernatural. What is that all about? Well, there is a supernatural dimension, and two of the tapes are with Joanna Michelson, who is a medium and had witnessed a number of supernatural occurrences, psychic surgery, if you want to call it that. Over 400 of these were people who had been given up by doctors, were suddenly cured of terrible, terrible diseases. And, of course, the four-tape set, The Supernatural, begins to introduce you to these ideas, and then, of course, we have, in addition, the book that Joanna wrote called The Beautiful Side of Evil. That's The Beautiful Side of Evil. So we ask you, of course, if you're interested and like more information, our number 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Remember, our webpage is radioliberty.com. Please encourage others to listen to our programs. It's up to you. We'll put the information out, but you've got to get people to hear it. And then pray for America. Pray for revival, but please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.